This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 11th. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Verna Avery Brown. For the first time in 38 years, a federal execution in the U.S., as Timothy McVeigh is killed by lethal injection.
Felt real good, sir.
We were happy.
I'm elated.
We are simply too human to extract so final and irreversible a punishment.
56 women who were stripped and groped in Central Park seek healing and justice 1 year after the attack. And 4,000 union activists rally in South Carolina over the weekend, protesting criminal charges against five dock workers. We'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At 8 a.m. Eastern Time, the U.S. government put to death Timothy McVeigh for his part in the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. President Bush had this to say.
The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing have been given not vengeance, but justice. And one young man met the fate he chose for himself 6 years ago. Under the laws of our country, the matter is concluded.
Ellen Ratner reports on what she saw in Terre Haute, Indiana, the site of the execution.
What I mainly saw was an absolute media circus, unlike almost anything I've seen except perhaps for the Democratic convention, a Republican convention, and of course the Monica situation. This ranks right up there, the number of satellite trucks. The Bureau of Prisons allowed people to, in fact, talk on the stage. They allowed the media witnesses, the 10 media witnesses, and they also, I believe there were actually 11 media witnesses, to observe, to talk from the stage that they had set up. They let the family members talk from the stage that they had set up. The McVeigh's attorneys were not allowed the stage, which had all the sound system, etc. They were out in the field with people holding handheld microphones and cameras to get their report on the execution.
That was Ellen Ratner for Free Speech Radio News. Looking a little green, President Bush accepts what scientists have been saying for years about global warming. Amanda Blitz has more from the White House.
Today at the White House, President Bush agreed with scientists and stated that the temperature of the Earth's surface has risen 0.6 degrees Celsius over the last 100 years. He also stated that the United States is the largest emitter of man-made greenhouse gases, accounting for 20% of the world's man-made emissions. Bush recognized the state's responsibility to reduce emissions, but outlined,
"We also recognize the other part of the story, that the rest of the world emits 80% of all greenhouse gases, and many of those emissions come from developing countries."
Despite America's clear and obvious contribution to the global warming problem, President Bush rejected the Kyoto Protocol to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and argued that it was flawed because major contributors of emissions, such as China and India, were excluded from the protocol. As President Bush heads to Europe tonight, he will face much criticism, given that Europe will most likely favor the Kyoto Protocol. For Free Speech News, this is Amanda Blitz.
The U.S. Supreme Court said religious groups can use public schools if they want to meet after school hours. The majority of six said it was discriminatory for schools to prohibit religious meetings on the ground. However, Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, said the justices didn't see the whole picture.
This club is called Good News, Good Sports, which kind of sounds like it's a basketball club where your kid wins every game. It's not. It's aggressive evangelism that teaches your children that at the age of six, if they haven't converted to Christianity, they will go to hell. Now, that's a pretty aggressive message, and I think somehow that's been lost in the discussion of this case, lost at least by a majority of the members of the court.
The justices said that allowing the groups to meet did not amount to an endorsement of a particular religion. President Mohammad Khatami won the Iranian election by a landslide. The final ballot count out today shows he won 77% of the vote. Triparsi of the Iranian Free International Corporation explains why.
People, although they are justifiably disappointed with the pace of reform and because of all the setbacks, they do understand that this is the only non-violent way of changing and reforming the Iranian society. They're not in a position in which they can opt for any other alternative path towards democracy. He has given Iran a different face by showing that this is not a country of fanatic people whose main purpose in life is to make life difficult for people in the West. It's really not the case.
U.S. sanctions against Iran expire in August. This week, the Congress is expected to reconsider those sanctions. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
It's been 38 years since the U.S. has executed one of its citizens. Today ended that unofficial moratorium. Timothy McVeigh, convicted for the murders of 168 people in the Oklahoma City bombing, was put to death at 7:15 a.m. Central Time in Terre Haute, Indiana. The state killing was the target of immense media coverage, with witnesses for the state, McVeigh, and the families of the victims on hand. From Terre Haute, Rennie McKay reports.
The execution of Timothy McVeigh, the American terrorist, came off without any major complications and no resistance from McVeigh, according to the warden of the prison, Harley Lappin.
Inmate McVeigh was calm throughout the entire process. He cooperated entirely. During the time, he was restrained in the execution holding cell. To the time he walked into the execution room, he stepped up onto a small step and sat down on the table. We then positioned himself. He then positioned himself for us to apply the restraints. He cooperated throughout this entire process.
Three groups of witnesses stood only a few feet from McVeigh behind glass and curtain. A group of 10 survivors and family members of victims. A group of four people McVeigh invited to watch, including two of his lawyers, Robert Nye and Nathan Chambers. McVeigh asked his family not to come. And in the last group were prison officials and 10 members of the media, including CBS News' Byron Pitts.
When the curtains came back, he made eye contact with his people who came to support him. When the curtain passed the media center, Mr. McVeigh seemed to look up and intentionally make eye contact with each of us.
After making a general statement, Karen Grundin, a reporter with the Terre Haute Tribune Star, talked about making eye contact with McVeigh. She says the implications of that didn't sink in until moments before we spoke.
Obviously, it's just been a little time afterwards, but I mean, the whole thing as a whole just seemed very sterile, in a sense anticlimactic. After the first drug was administered, he remained still, as far as I could tell.
Just before that drug, a sedative, was administered, about 7:10 a.m., he was asked to give his last words, but he remained silent. Afterward, the warden told reporters that he hadn't said anything, but McVeigh did prepare a written statement. It was a copy of William Henley's poem, Invictus. Byron Pitts read that poem to reporters, and it ends,
"I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." He signs it at the end, June 11, 2001.
This poem is criticized for having an arrogant tone. Paul Howell lost his daughter in the bombing. He watched the execution and says he had hoped to hear McVeigh say something to show his emotions. But Howell, along with Anthony Scott and Sue Ashford, two other witnesses, say they were satisfied today.
My emotions was it was just a big relief. Just a big sigh come over my body and just felt real good, sir.
We were happy.
I'm elated.
Scott then spoke about what he thinks the long-term impact of McVeigh's execution will be.
I don't think this is meant to for deterrence. It's definitely a deterrent to Timothy McVeigh. I mean, you can't judge the mind of anybody else to say whether this might deter them from doing something, you know, as heinous as what he did, but we don't know.
Scott and the others from Oklahoma City could not be seen by McVeigh through the tinted glass, and more than 200 others watched the proceedings through the closed-circuit TV in Oklahoma. Joining them this morning was Attorney General John Ashcroft, who thanked them for their courage but left before the execution occurred, although he was on the phone with the prison during the execution. Robert Nye, a lawyer for McVeigh, who was also watching the execution, spoke about how the Justice Department and the FBI tainted the process by failing to turn over more than 3,000 pages of documents until after McVeigh stopped the appeals process.
This must make us realize that we are too fallible. We are simply too human to extract so final and irreversible a punishment. If there is anything good that can come from the execution of Tim McVeigh, it may be to help us realize sooner that we simply cannot do this anymore.
Nye says he hopes that people will show their outrage at the system and help to convince people like John Ashcroft to put a moratorium on executions before next Tuesday, when Juan Raul Garza, a convicted marijuana dealer and killer, is set to be executed in Terre Haute. That doesn't seem likely, as polls suggest upwards of 70% of the country supported McVeigh's execution. 168 people died as a result of McVeigh's bombing. His remains will be cremated and taken to an undisclosed place. He said he doesn't wish to create a place that would attract his enemies or those who sympathize with him. In Terre Haute, I'm Rennie McKay for Free Speech Radio News.
Opponents of the death penalty cite among their reasons for opposition the propensity in the system for error. A man who spent the last 3 years sitting on Florida's death row for a crime he was later exonerated for is now free. 30-year-old Joaquin Martinez was convicted and sentenced to death in 1997 for the murder of a couple at their Tampa home in 1995. But the Florida Supreme Court reversed the conviction last year and ordered a new trial, citing errors by the prosecution. A Spanish national, Martinez returned home to his native Spain, where, along with the entire European Union, capital punishment has been outlawed. Reporter Rochelle Renford is in Florida, where she's been following the Martinez case and files this report.
Joaquin Martinez returned to Spain yesterday after spending nearly 3 years on Florida's death row. Martinez was sentenced to death in 1997 after he was found guilty of the murders of a Claremont, Florida couple, Douglas Lawson and his girlfriend, Sherry McCoy Ward. Florida Supreme Court overturned the conviction and granted Martinez a new trial last year. Last Wednesday, a jury returned a not guilty verdict, and Martinez was released from prison. The Martinez case drew an onslaught of attention from around the world. Pope John Paul II made an appeal to U.S. officials on Martinez's behalf, and the King of Spain spoke out as well. Spanish citizens and the media in Spain followed the story closely, and hundreds of thousands of dollars were raised for Martinez's defense. Many Spanish reporters were on hand when the verdict was read last week, and the verdict was broadcast live in Spain. The retrial was ordered when the Supreme Court found that a detective in the first trial improperly told the jury he thought Martinez was guilty. Nick Cox, the prosecutor in the first trial, then repeated the detective's opinion to the jury in his closing arguments. Cox says that he was not trying to convict Martinez on the detective's opinion. In the period of time between the two trials, the prosecution's case had eroded. Martinez's ex-wife, who had initially said that Martinez had made incriminating statements to her, changed her story. Also, one witness had died and another refused to cooperate. Taped conversations of Martinez and his ex-wife, which helped the jury to reach a guilty verdict the first time, were ruled inaudible. Later, it was revealed that the father of one of the murder victims, William Lawson, who had been evidence manager of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, had been the one to prepare the transcripts of the tapes. The release of Martinez coincides with President Bush's European tour, which begins in Spain on Tuesday. Nearly 3,000 protesters in Spain took to the streets to protest the president's visit and to voice their opposition to his position on the death penalty. That the U.S. continues to impose a death penalty puts it at odds with European countries, which have abolished the practice. Like many of his countrymen, Martinez sees the death penalty as barbaric and has vowed to dedicate himself to stopping the practice. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rochelle Renford.
Shouting death to Israel and death to Sharon, about 4,000 mourners attended the funeral of three Bedouin women who were sitting in a family tent near the Netzarim Jewish settlement in Gaza when they were killed by three Israeli tank shells. Israeli army officials say the tanks fired at two armed figures who were in an open area near the Jewish settlement after nearby Israeli army positions came under Palestinian fire. The women's deaths were the first fatalities since Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat promised a ceasefire on June 1st. More from Raphael Kraft in Gaza.
The words, the slogans, and the flags do not change from one funeral to another. Three Palestinian women were killed by a tank that shelled their Bedouin camp last Saturday night near the Jewish settlement of Netzarim in the middle of the Gaza Strip. 1,000 people joined the procession that took place in Nusayrat in the Gaza Strip yesterday, brandishing yellow flags for Hezbollah, green for Hamas. This new breakout of violence has given more reason for Palestinians to believe in and follow Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad's course of action. Abdelaziz Rantisi is one of the Hamas leaders in the Gaza Strip.
As long as there is occupation, we are going to go ahead in our struggle.
Israeli forces said their soldiers responded to some shots fired at them by Palestinian gunmen hiding in an outpost near the Bedouin camp. The shells used by Israeli forces that killed the three Bedouin women were filled with needle bullets. These little metallic darts scatter around when the shell explodes, increasing its range, killing or heavily wounding the people around. Israeli forces, who have used the same weapon in Lebanon, confirmed this information. few hours after the death of the three women, Israeli government declared that stone throwing should be included in the ceasefire agreement. The tank was located beside the road leading to the Netzarim Jewish settlement. A Palestinian village stands in its vicinity opposite the Bedouin village located on the other side of the road. According to its inhabitants, the tank not only shelled the Bedouin village. Mohammed Hassan Abdi is the teacher of the village.
After evening, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, shot fire from Israel. The baton stopped near the mosque and shot fire. The north and south, east, west, there is no house.
Since CIA Director George Stennett arrived in Israel and Palestine last Thursday to implement the ceasefire and revive the peace process, nothing changed, neither on the ground nor on the diplomatic agenda. Israeli government says it will start freezing the settlement construction only after the violence stops. On the other side, the Palestinian Authority wants the settlements to be frozen before being able to implement the ceasefire. As many observers say, settlements are likely to be the cause of the violences that specifies the death of the three Palestinian women last Saturday night. Although diplomatic efforts are carried on by both European Union and the United States, the Israeli policy of intimidation continues. More than the shootings and the house and land demolition, most of the inhabitants living near a Jewish settlement are subdued to a curfew every night and are constantly incited to abandon their houses. In the meantime, Ariel Sharon prides himself to implement his policy of restraint despite the growing anger of Israelis. After calling Yasser Arafat a pathological liar and terrorist, Ariel Sharon is now comparing the Palestinian leader to Osama bin Laden. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in the Gaza Strip.
1 year ago today, 56 women were sexually assaulted by a large crowd of men in Central Park during and after New York City's Puerto Rican Day parade. The men doused in water, stripped, fondled, and molested woman after woman who passed by. Several of those women attempted to get the police to intervene, but reported being met with indifference. On Saturday, a coalition of activists and civil rights groups marked the anniversary of the attacks with a rally in Central Park. From Manhattan, Craig Heimsen reports.
On the corner of 6th Avenue and Central Park South, dozens of women and men rallied in remembrance of what happened last year, only a few yards away. They demanded that women have the right to venture safely into public spaces.
Extra, extra. Did you hear the news today? Over 55 women were sexually assaulted after the parade.
Ann Peyton Bryant is one of the women who was assaulted last year. She says that after being attacked in plain view of the police, she and a friend approached a dozen different officers for help, but they took little interest in assisting her.
There's never a day that I leave my house that I don't think about this.
Last Friday, Bryant and 11 other women announced that they are suing the city of New York for $1 billion. The two police officers disciplined for negligence during Bryant's attack had 15 vacation days revoked. For Bryant, that's not justice. She wants the city to be held accountable for what happened.
I used to be the kind of woman that walked out of her house and I felt protected if I felt like I was on a safe block. I felt that I could rely on the police. If I saw a police officer, I felt at ease. And the reality is I got attacked across from the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And it can happen anywhere, anytime, and police were right nearby and didn't do anything. Not only were they not responding when I asked for help, but we know that they were close by in the vicinity. So it's sad. I think that people should listen to that as a message that it's the most important thing you can do for yourself to know how to protect yourself.
New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani put more police on the street for this year's parade and vowed to do so for future large public events. But rally organizer Fran Luck doesn't think more police are the solution. She says prevailing cultural attitudes men have toward women need to change.
This administration uses any excuse to have police, 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 police. Police in prisons are supposed to be the answer to all problems. And we're saying this is outrageous. Police and prisons are not going to stop the abuse and harassment of women. We're not looking for a militarized society.
Fran Luck says that last year's assaults were not isolated incidents, and they had nothing in particular to do with the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which is why they staged the rally a day before this year's celebration. Instead, she says, they were a result of attitudes of male supremacy that lead to the daily harassment of women. Those attitudes cut across all racial, ethnic, and class lines.
We're looking for people, regular people, to become active in changing these attitudes and stopping these things from happening. We want women, when they see this happening to another woman, to stop and be a team with that woman and help her and confront the man together with her. And we need to enlist men to confront other men. We want to create an atmosphere where this is socially not acceptable.
John Breitbart attended the rally because he believes men have a crucial role to play in changing the social climate that allows harassment and abuse to occur.
Every man knows a woman in their life who's experienced violence or harassment from men. And I think that men need to be aware of the injustice and the violence, and that if they've become aware of it, they need to do something to change the situation. And it's not about labels, being labeled a feminist. It's about taking a stand for something that's right. And men can be called to do that as well as women.
Of the 30 men arrested for last year's attacks, 14 were acquitted or had their charges dropped. 16 pled guilty and received sentences ranging from probation to 5 years in prison. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Craig Heimson in Manhattan.
This year's Puerto Rican Day Parade focused on one of the biggest news stories in New York's Puerto Rican community, the U.S. Navy bombing on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Four prominent New Yorkers, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, received harsh jail sentences for their civil disobedience protest last month against the bombings. Organizers and government officials banned anti-bombing groups from this year's annual Puerto Rican Day parade. But as Jeff Brady reports from New York, they were unsuccessful in suppressing protests of the U.S. government actions.
The theme of New York's annual Puerto Rican Day parade is ethnic pride. But this year, the subtext was the protest of U.S. Navy bombing exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, as hundreds of thousands of people lined Fifth Avenue waving flags and blowing whistles. Bronx Borough President and New York mayoral candidate Fernando Ferreira says the bombing has gone on long enough.
It's a terrible injustice. It's been going on for 61 years. The bombardment of American soil inhabited by American citizens is an outrage.
Ferreira says he also disagrees with the decision by the pro-Giuliani Parade Committee to ban more than 10 pro-Vieques groups from the parade, but the banning was unable to contain all political expression. Manny Oquendo was among a contingent of Vieques protesters holding up large images of four prominent New York leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, known as the Vieques Four. They're being held in a Brooklyn jail for trespassing on a restricted area during peaceful protests in Vieques.
Our government is taking advantage of people everywhere, and this is just one instance, and I'm glad that it's going where it is, and I'm glad Hillary Clinton is right behind us with the pictures right in front of us.
Walking a few steps behind the group that's holding up the large photographs of the Vieques Four was New York Senator Hillary Clinton. She was guarded by a dozen Secret Service men. Amid the screaming and chanting, Clinton says she too would like to see an end to the bombing.
I'm against it. It should stop.
Security was tight Sunday as 6,000 New York police officers were stationed along the parade route, 2,000 more than last year's event. Marchers passed through security checkpoints and metal detectors as they proceeded along the route. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani had pledged to step up the police presence in response to the brutal attacks committed against more than 50 women in Central Park 3 hours after last year's parade. While parade organizers say the attacks were not connected with the parade, others argue the New York Police Department has used the incident to stigmatize Puerto Ricans. The massive celebration of Puerto Rican pride ends in Spanish Harlem, where many headed home or relaxed in Central Park. So far, two cases of sexual assault were reported during the parade. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
Under dueling flags of the old Confederacy and the United States of America at the State House in Columbia, South Carolina, more than 4,000 union activists from around the South and across the country rallied this past Saturday. They were protesting criminal charges filed against five Charleston dock workers, members of International Longshoremen's Local 1422. The mostly African-American dockers had been peacefully picketing a non-union vessel in the Charleston Harbor in January of 2000, when the state's attorney general, Charles Condon, called in over 600 state militia in full riot gear who attacked the workers. He later took the case to a Charleston County grand jury that indicted five of the workers on criminal riot charges. Their trial is due to begin on June 25th. For Free Speech Radio News, Ken Nash reports from Columbia, South Carolina.
The rally was sponsored by the Coalition for Workers' Rights in South Carolina, which includes major labor and civil rights groups in the state and across the country, including the FFL-CIO and the NAACP. A majority of the 4,000 protesters outside the State House were from the labor community in the southern states, but buses brought workers from numerous unions from across the country, including Chicago, New York City, and the West Coast. AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Linda Chavez-Thompson committed the support of the National AFL-CIO to the defense of the Charleston Five.
These workers, all they were doing were exercising the right to picket and protest. Why are we having this problem about the freedom to join a union, about the freedom to have good wages? Is it because the ILA here is African American? They want to bust unions in South Carolina. Are we going to let them?
No!
They want to deny the rights to the Charleston Five. Are we going to let them?
No!
ILA local president Ken Riley vowed to help organize throughout South Carolina and announced a victory on this front to the enthusiastic rally on Saturday.
This is the new South, and you've got a brand new labor movement going on here in South Carolina. We're going to organize, and the workers that boarded those vessels to undermine our industry standard have now decided, well over 80% of them, that they want to become union.
Cecil Roberts, president of the United Mine Workers of America, echoed the strong support of the labor movement and promised to escalate the conflict by going to jail any time the ILA local asked him to do so.
These brothers, the Charleston Five, are my brothers. This is a decision of Kenny and those who have to live in South Carolina. If you elect to use Dr. King's tactics and turn this system upside down, inside out, I'll go to jail with you anytime you call upon me.
The rally received national and international dock workers' support, as well as the promise by Swedish dock worker Björn Borg of the International Dock Workers' Council, who called for closing down ports around the world on June 25th if the charges aren't dropped before the trial begins.
I'm here to bring solidarity and the support from 30,000 longshoremen from all corners of the world. If the charges are not dropped, if the Charleston Five are not being set free, and on that day of trial against our colleagues in Charleston, that day will not go unnoticed in ports around the world. Long live Workers' International Solidarity.
South Carolina has the lowest unionization rate in the South, which has the lowest unionization rate in the country. The unholy alliance between business and government, represented this time by the case of the Charleston Five, is one of the factors which have historically kept labor down in the Deep South. Another factor has been white racism, which has prevented the kinds of solidarity needed to organize the South. The AFL-CIO, under President John Sweeney, has made unionization of the South a high priority, and the Southern Rally bringing together white and black workers in support of the Charleston Five is a giant step in the right direction. But if the movement is to succeed, a greater commitment is needed from the national labor and civil rights communities. For Free Speech Radio News in Columbia, South Carolina, I'm Ken Nash with Mimi Rosenberg, fired labor reporters from Pacifica Radio Station, WBAI.
I'm Matt Martin, filling in for Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.